Why would anyone need to write a book called In Defense of Food? I mean, after all, if you can afford it and you can get your hands on it, you eat food several times a day. Or do you? According to today's guest, Michael Pollan, most of what we're all consuming isn't food. He calls it something like edible food-like substances. Not only that, he goes on to say that how we're consuming it is not really eating. It's something we do pretty unconsciously as we work or drive or watch TV. You all know about the U.S. epidemic of obesity and diabetes over the past 25 years, on top of the steady rise of chronic diseases over the past 100. Yet paradoxically, Americans and the food industry have become ever more aware of nutrition. So what's going on here? Pollan claims that in the Western diet, good old food has been replaced by nutrients, mom's good advice by nutritional experts, common sense by confusion, and for most, a relatively good diet by a bad and dangerous one. The book in which he makes all these claims and advises us simply to eat food, not too much, mostly plants, is the number one selling book in Southern California and on the New York Times bestseller list. Michael Pollan is the author of In Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto. His previous books include The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, named one of the 10 best books of 2006 by the New York Times and the Washington Post, and The Botany of Desire. Pollan is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and a Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley. Welcome, Michael Pollan.
Thank you, Terry. Good to be here.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work. So how did you grow to focus on plants and then food?
Well, all my work really begins in the garden. I was a very passionate gardener beginning at age 8, although I fell away from it for a few years. But in the 1980s, I was living in New York and took up gardening at a weekend house in northwestern Connecticut. And I got very absorbed in the garden as a place to look at our relationship to nature. Like a lot of Americans, my understanding of nature and our relationship to it was shaped by Emerson and Thoreau and, you know, Melville and Whitman and all this kind of stuff. And when I actually started to garden, I realized all those books and all those ideas about nature were distinctly unhelpful. Thoreau's love of wilderness and worship of the wild, and Emerson's as well, really didn't equip you when the pests came and destroyed your crops, when the woodchuck attacked your broccoli. And I realized that that kind of romance of nature wasn't actually that helpful. And I got into trouble because I was following their philosophy. I didn't have a fence, for example. I thought a fence was too alienating, you know, from the natural world. I won't go into all the details, but I got into kind of a war with a woodchuck that you just
and
picture
how,
Bill
how
Murray and
how
Caddyshack.
Old are
you? Well, at this point, now I'm in my 30s or late 20s. And in this escalating series until I was like defoliating my property and pouring gasoline down a woodchuck burrow. And it was, you know, I was like William Westmoreland in Vietnam. I just, you know, I was willing to destroy the village to save the village kind of thing. And realized then that the garden was a very interesting place to examine our relationship to the natural world, that so much of the beauty and the, you know, the difficult parts of that relationship are played out in gardens. And traditionally, when Americans want to think about nature, we picture the wilderness. We go camping. We go to Yosemite. But, you know, nature is happening in our homes, in our gardens, in our lawns, and on our plates. And so, you know, that was what I got attracted to, that very messy area where we need to change nature because here we are and we have to eat. And but are there ways we can change nature that actually redound to nature's benefit and our own?
And this is a period when you're writing about other things?
Yeah, I was. Well, actually, this is a period when I was an editor. I was an editor at Harper's Magazine. I began writing a series of essays about what was happening to me in my garden, my woodchuck war, my dad's battle with the neighbors over his front lawn, you know, all these kind of issues that became my first book, Second Nature. So that has remained the kind of place I like to work. And if you do that, inevitably, yeah, you'll start looking at our relationship to plants, our relationship to animals, both of which I've written about, drugs, since a lot of the drugs are plants that change our consciousness. What is that all about?
And that shows up
about
in the Botany of Desire.
Yeah, Botany of Desire.
Yeah.
Beauty, you know, there are all these just different issues that you can tease out of what's happening in the garden. And that's what I've done. And so it was kind of inevitable I'd get to food eventually. And when I was working on Botany of Desire, I took a look at genetically modified food. In fact, I grew some genetically modified potatoes in this garden I'm describing after I had my fence up, and tried to figure out what was that all about. You know, if this is the next chapter in our relationship to plants, is it a good one or a bad one? And when I was doing that, I visited industrial farms in Idaho to see how industrial agriculture works, and I was shocked. I was absolutely floored by these vast monocultures, the amount of pesticides that are used, the fact that the farmers are afraid to go into their fields after they spray for fungus for 5 days because they know how neurotoxic this stuff is.
The stuff which will later end up on our plates.
Yeah, in our food. And in fact, that they would often have a little patch of organic potatoes by the house for themselves because they could not eat the food coming out of their farms. It suggests they're more irresponsible than they are. Over time, the potatoes leach out the worst chemicals. So you just can't dig potatoes, industrial potatoes, and eat them right away or you'll, you know, get too heavy load of residues. And I also visited organic farms, and I realized that there were alternatives, and people were having great success growing organic on a fairly large scale in Idaho with a completely different mindset, not monoculture being the key fact, heavy rotations, polycropping, and all this kind of stuff. So that really got me very excited to take a hard look at the food chain that we're a part of. And when I realized that that really is our most profound engagement with the natural world, what happens on our plates, this dictates the composition of species in the world, which ones we favor, which ones we disfavor, the reason there are, you know, plenty of cows and not too many wolves left. It's the way we've shaped the landscape in terms of, you know, deforesting it for our fields. And it affects us profoundly. What we choose to grow, what we don't grow, has a huge bearing on our health and our happiness. So that's kind of how – that was the path that took me into looking at food.
Yeah. I shared with you before we went on the air, I actually did an organic acre in 1971.
Those were really the early days.
Yeah. And it was a profound experience which has stayed with me ever since and, you know, gave up red meat in 69, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's been interesting to see, in a way, almost cycles of interest in this. In other words, in the 70s, there was an interest in all of this. But it's as the thing that I think is very interesting among many things, I highly recommend the book In Defense of Food, is what you have to say about nutritionism, that paradox that I mentioned in the intro, that as actually people probably talk more about nutrition and see more ads that mention nutrition, the science of nutrition, these ingredients, these nutrients, in fact,
our diet is less and less healthy.
Yeah, it's less and less healthy.
Well, it's not a coincidence. I mean, we've stuffed our brains with biochemistry. I mean, the way we talk about food, we talk about antioxidants. I mean, you know, ordinary people on the street are talking about antioxidants. Whether they understand them is another question. Cholesterol, you know, fiber, polyphenols, phytochemicals, all this has, you know, become the language of food. And the food is disappearing. If you look at the packages in the stores, it's all these nutrients. And this is an ideology. It's nutritionism.
Right.
It's an ism. It's not a science. It's and the ideology, it has four premises. And you tell me if these don't reflect the average understanding of food. The first one is that nutrients are what matters. It's not the food. It's the nutrient. You're getting enough of the good ones and, you know, avoiding the bad ones. The second is, like any other ism, it divides the world into good and evil.
By the way, after your first one, that's what I was going to say. And there always is a good one and a bad one. Well, that's the second premise.
There's always some satanic nutrient we're trying to derive from the food supply.
And when one is up, another one's down.
Exactly.
And I think by now people are, when they see something is good for them, they're waiting for when's the report going to come out that it's not.
Yeah, right. Well, I remember my mother when, you know, she was dutifully giving us all margarine instead of butter. And she would say, someday they're going to figure out that actually butter is better for you than margarine. And we thought she was nuts. But in fact, it turned out that the margarine was lethal and the butter, butter is fine.
It's interesting that she was feeding it to you, suspecting that would happen.
It.
But that's that bind we're
that's
in as
exactly
citizens, right?
The authority of mothers was essentially destroyed by the food industry. The $32 billion a year in marketing muscle out there has undercut culture's role in determining what we eat. Now, culture's a fancy word for your mom, basically.
Exactly. Just to emphasize that number, $32 billion, that's not the food industry. That's the food marketing industry, budget. $32
That's
billion.
Advertising, studying us, packaging, figuring out how to get us to eat more. Let me just
mention one thing. I remember I attended a panel on these issues about obesity and diabetes and so on. And the food folks in the panel said, well, listen, we're all for public education. We don't think we should regulate this sort of thing because Americans believe in individualism and free choice, but we certainly should educate them. And someone pointed out, yeah, so maybe we'll do $100 million of education up against that $32 billion.
$100 million is one snack food annual budget, okay? The entire USDA, FDA effort to educate people about food equals one chip. Okay? So there's no contest. I mean, they control the information about food.
Third
premise. So there's always a good nutrient, evil nutrient. Third premise is that the whole point of eating is to advance your health or ruin your health, and that's what food is about. Now, Americans accept that idea, but it's actually quite strange. And if you go to other countries, you remember very quickly that people have eaten for a great many reasons other than health. They eat for pleasure. They eat for community, communion. They eat to express their identity. They eat for ritual purposes. And these are all equally legitimate reasons to eat. And for some reason, though, they fall away. The fourth premise is, of course, if the nutrient is the key unit in food, nutrients are invisible. No one's ever seen, tasted, or smelled a nutrient. So you need experts to guide you in your food choices. You need scientists. You need journalists. You need it's like a religion. If what matters is invisible and inaccessible to you directly, you need a priesthood. And now we have a food priesthood. And we have the health claims on the packages. We have the nutritionists that we listen to on radio, television, and we have lost any confidence in our mothers, in ourselves, in our instincts to determine what is good food. It's understandable that we would have done that because we can't trust our instincts because so many of the foods now lie to us with artificial flavorings, artificial sweeteners, artificial fats. So that has kind of cast us adrift in a way that we need experts, supposedly. And what I'm trying to do in this book is kind of show you by taking apart the science that we can't rely on scientists or food scientists, the people designing these products, to feed us, and that they haven't, that their advice hasn't been that good. In fact, not out of any evil intent,
right.
But nutrition is a very young science, to put it charitably. They may get better at it, but they've only been at it for about 170 years, and the whole history of nutrition science is one missed nutrient after another. They kept thinking, okay, carbohydrates, fats, protein, that's it. That's all you need. So then they would design, a baby formula, and it would have the macronutrients. Somehow the babies didn't thrive. Or you'd send men on long sea voyages and give them plenty of carbohydrate, protein, and fat, and they still got sick. So then we discovered, we need the vitamins also. Here are these other nutrients. And then we gave people that, and it still didn't quite work. Baby formula, still wasn't successful. What was missing? Well, it turns out there were omega-3 fatty acids that were missing. So that's the whole history of finding every decade or two, we find another level of absolutely critical nutrients
that we
overlook. And it's partially
that science in its own way gets better. That is to say, more able to pull these things apart and find the single nutrient and do the studies and so on. Not necessarily better in actually delivering the information that's good for health. But I wanted to ask a sort of a upstream question of that. In this food discussion, what came first, the chicken or the egg kind of? How did – we need to feed people. Mm-hmm. People need to be healthy. If it becomes the way it's become, then there's a nutrition industry. How did this all start? In other words, as you say, I think at one point in one of your you have three – basic things, which I said in the intro, and we'll get back to: eat food, mostly plants, not too much. But you also say, and you then lay out more rules, kind of corollaries from those, and to navigate our way into those three rules. And one of them is anything your great grandmother wouldn't recognize. And your point there is that for as long as your mother and your grandmother's been around, it's gotten cloudy. How did that begin? What led to this crazy upside down reality? Yeah.
I think it's really built into the nature of the food industry and the economics of selling food. It's very hard to make money selling real, normal, unprocessed foods. You know, you ask any farmer who's growing broccoli or oatmeal, oats, you know, it's a very hard way to make money growing those commodities, essentially. You make money processing food. The more you process food, the more profitable it is. So you start, you might start with oats, right? But you know, if you go to the supermarket, I can buy a pound of organic oats for 79 cents. Now, oats are light. That is a lot of oats. And nobody's making a lot of money. It's only 79 cents. But if you turn it into Cheerios, suddenly you have a brand. You've got your little donut shape and you've got an ad campaign and you've suddenly you're charging $4 for, you know, a few ounces of oats and you've processed it and you've offered convenience. And then you step up again to the Honey Nut Cheerio cereal bar with the layer of artificial milk in the middle. And now you've got a convenience food that's very much your own because you've got this special formula to make your fake milk. And kids can eat them in the car or on the way to school. And now you're charging, what, $10 or $20 for a few pennies worth of oats. So that's the gist of the food industry. That's the economic imperative.
So following the money is the short answer to that. Now, one thing I must share with you, I was in Minnesota at one point talking to some women, and we were in Battle Creek, Michigan. And I said, oh, you know, the home of is it General Mills or Kellogg's, one of them.
Kellogg's.
And they said, you know, they've really taken a hit lately. The cereals are way down in sales. And I said, why? They said, because you can't eat them in the car. Thus, cereal bars.
Exactly right. And now we have cereal straws. But the problem is that the more you process this food, the less nutritious it is. So the economic imperative takes you in one direction. The biological imperative is saying, leave it alone. There's nothing better for you for breakfast than plain oats. You know, cook them yourself. And so what you do is, with your processed product, you need to be able to make a health claim to counter that. So you fortify it. You throw in whatever the hot nutrient.
Well, let me just see if when you process it, which you're doing because you're the food industry and not a farmer, you are usually removing
nutrients.
Some of the value,
right.
Some of the nutrients. So then that's why you have to then
add them back in.
That you purify, you process, you do all, you refine, and then you add things back in, and now you make a claim for what you added
back
in.
As if you've done a big favor.
Now, one question that seems to me is if regular food. You know, small letter food, the stuff that our great grandmother was putting on the table, gives us what we need and tastes good. Why have we fallen for it?
Well, a lot of reasons. One is marketing. The other is convenience. We want to be liberated from the drudgery of cooking, or at least we've been convinced
we
want to be liberated.
And in America, even the drudgery of eating.
And even the drudgery of eating. That's right. I mean, as Wendell Berry said back in the 70s, you know, if the food industry could digest your food for it, you know, profitably, they would do that. They would reach down your throat and, you know, mush it up for you.
The Jetsons, right?
They would, or the pill, the food, the meal and the pill. That's the ultimate dream of the food industry. And, you know, to get us to eat 24/7, to snack. So they have to do value added. And the value they've added most successfully is convenience, liberating women from the kitchen, cooking for us, chewing for us, you know, everything.
I often say, by the way, that this civilization is going to die by convenience. and if you look at almost every mistake we're making, one has to do with greed and
labor
profit.
Labor saving.
But that convenience thing, and, you know.
It's very seductive.
It's very seductive. I want you to go quickly through your three rules and kind of, you know, what's underneath
them.
And then I have like a sort of a big question about this, what this means about all of society, kind of. So eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yeah. Well, you know, I tried to boil everything I was learning down as much as I could. And I realized, God, I can say this whole thing in 7 words. Uh-oh, is anyone going to buy a book?
And you say it on the cover.
And I give it away on the cover. But the challenge is, of course... Well, eat food sounds really obvious, but how do you distinguish the food from the edible food-like substances that are masquerading as food? And so I spent 14 pages defining food in this book, and you know, which is something that really shouldn't need to be done. I mean, in fact, this entire book, as you suggest in your intro, really shouldn't be necessary, but I'm afraid it is.
And actually, if you told someone 100 years ago...
Yeah, that I'm going to write a number one bestseller telling people how to eat real food... It's a crazy idea to contemplate. So I have a bunch of rules that help you distinguish the food from the edible food. One is, you know, don't eat anything your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. And that's kind of an algorithm. You know, carry her with you in your imagination as you're rolling down the aisles of the supermarket. When you pick up those, you know, Go-Gurt portable yogurt tubes, Would she know what to do with that tube? Would she know how to administer it to her body? Would she recognize the ingredients in it? And the answer is no, she wouldn't. That's not really food. You know, yogurt is a very simple, wonderful food. It's milk in a bacterial culture. So what are those other 15 ingredients doing in there?
Yeah.
Good question. Let me
jump in for one quick second. When you said that sort of an algorithm, listeners, when you buy this book and read it, you won't find 100 rules.
What
Michael attempts to do is, if you have certain principles, algorithms in mind, you'll make your own decisions.
Such as, if you are in the supermarket, shop the perimeter of the store. That is where you will find the foods that have been least fiddled with in the last 75 years. The fresh produce, the meat, the fish, the dairy products. Although there are a couple exceptions, like those Go-Gurt portable yogurt tubes that snuck into the perimeter. But in general, the stuff that's really going to get you in trouble with all the added fat, added sugar, salt, is the processed goods in the middle, the stuff with the long shelf life. So if you can do your shopping along the edge, you're going to be a lot better off. And you'll be much better off still if you leave the supermarket entirely and do your shopping in a farmer's market. All that is food. Your great-grandmother would know exactly what's there. There might be some exotic vegetables she hasn't seen, but basically she knows what that stuff is and she knows what to do with it.
And for you folks who are in Southern California, she would have been lucky if she lived here, where there is a farmer's market.
Exactly.
Basically, within LA, you can find one every single day of the week within about 10 miles of you,
and all year
they
long.
Have stuff all year long.
Yeah, we're very lucky. I mean, there's no excuse for Californians to not eat well, eat real food, because it's all around. So I have a whole bunch of rules that are, you know, just kind of algorithms to help you. None of them are phrased as science. I'm not saying, you know, eat this food, don't eat that, avoid salt, sugar. I'm not interested in any of that. The idea is to get some cultural rules.
One other thing. We're not going to have time in the course of this interview to really get into the health effects of the food industry and the food-like substances and this whole thing that Michael laid out earlier of, you know, one nutrient after another seeming to be the culprit or the savior. But it's in there, and it's a big part of this, which will, I think, illuminate for you something that probably has you a bit confused. But so – not too much.
Not too much is the issue of quantity. You know, we live in times of abundance, and the amount we're eating is a big part of our problem, especially because we're so sedentary. So, you know, it's not enough to just tell people eat less. What I tried to do is find other cultures and cultural rules that would govern appetite, which, you know, there have been other periods of abundance and other cultures have dealt with this problem, and they all have very interesting methods. The Japanese on Okinawa, and this is true of the Chinese too, have a cultural rule that you eat until you're 4/5 full, 80% full. Now, how do you know when you're 80% full? I don't know, but if you just stop before you were completely full, that would be huge progress.
I've got to interrupt. I, at one point, I'm about to turn 60. At one point, about 8 years ago, I suddenly weighed about a dozen pounds more than I'd ever weighed. And I thought, you know, it crept up, but it's happening. My metabolism must have changed with age. All I did was decided I would be more conscious about when I wasn't hungry anymore.
Yeah.
And in a little over a year, I lost 25 pounds. I've put on about 10 of it back, so I'm back where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
But if you tell people who struggle, now maybe I'm lucky, but still, that's all it was I don't need to finish this sandwich. I don't need to finish this helping.
Well, you know, Americans are particularly driven by visual cues in their eating. And there have been psychologists who've compared us to the French. And you ask an American, well, when do you know when to stop eating? And they'll say, when the plate's empty.
Or when the TV show's over.
Or the TV show's over. Or the bag is empty. And if you ask, you know, if you ask a European, they'll say, well, when I feel full. The problem with us is, too, we also eat so fast. You know, it takes the stomach about 20 minutes to notify the brain that it's had enough. But if you finish your meal in 10 minutes, you know, you're going to be in really deep before you know that you've eaten too much. So slowing down is a very important part of eating better.
So not too much and not too fast.
Not
probably
too fast.
Goes together.
Yeah, the slower you eat, the less you will eat, even if you're spending all that time. The French, very interestingly, they get more food experience on less calories.
And by food experience.
Spending time with food, enjoying food, savoring it, thinking about it, anticipating it. I mean, they're obsessed with it. But, you know, what do you really want? Do you want calories or do you want food experience? I think most of us would say they really want food experience. And the two things aren't necessarily correlated, except in the mind of the American consumer who has been taught that food is about quantity rather than quality.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to leave number three, the mostly plants, for people to buy the book. But I want to share with you something. This is kind of a big question, but it's like, over the last few weeks, I've had the privilege to interview Lester Brown, founder of World Watch, has a plan 3.0 for mobilizing to save civilization. You know, a big picture look at energy and environment. Nobel Peace Prize winner, Muhammad Yunus, about creating a world without poverty through social business. Laura Flanders about the grassroots involved. All of these things seem to me to share something. And that something is that we're looking at systems, we're looking at relationships, we're looking at bottom up, we're looking at local, we're looking at, it seems to me, both this makes me hopeful that all this stuff is percolating, and it seems that it's about a worldview almost. In other words, I could be having this conversation with someone about the American healthcare system,
mm-hmm.
and it would be very similar. We look at symptoms, we look exactly. for the magic bullet, we put out things with side effects, but we...
That's a great example. I mean, the food issue and the healthcare issue are seen as separate issues. And of course, they're not. When I was a boy in 1960, we spent... 18% of our income on food, twice as much as we do today, and only 5% of our national income on healthcare. Today, it's flipped. We spend 16 or 17% of our income on healthcare and only 9% of our income on food. So you see, the less money we've been willing to spend for food, the more we've settled for processed, highly refined, cheap, fast food.
And what's amazing,
the more our healthcare problems.
What's amazing with that statistic is that we eat out much more than we did.
Yeah, half our food dollars.
So if we're spending less on food and we're eating out much more,
imagine.
It means we're spending that much less. And what you've said is that we've learned to increase yields, we've learned to make energy and calories cheaper, but we've lost
the value. Well, we've taken
this
solar technology, the original solar technology, which is photosynthesis, you know, making food from sunlight, and we put it on fossil fuel. One of the great mistakes. So now we're taking 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food energy. It doesn't have to be that way. And in fact, food is easier to re-solarize than a lot of things in our society. So
we've got to wrap
potential.
This up. But that quick thing that I was referring to of this holistic system, I mean, there's something going on here that an awful lot of our ills seem to come out of one worldview and an awful lot of our cures
come out of another. No question about it. Seeing things as systems, seeing food as a system and your body as a system and these two things interacting and looking at it ecologically, learning to think ecologically, looking where did the energy come from.
Which is not about the environment. It's about the system in which we live.
It's deeper than that.
So again, the book is In Defense of Food. The website is michaelpollan.com. Thank you, Michael Pollan. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, Terry.